Our argument in Copper Mountain versus Industrial Systems, and the petitioner may proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court, counsel. I'm Elizabeth Harris, and I represent Copper Mountain. For more than a decade, the answer to the question presented in this case, what is the scope of the waiver of a subrogation provision in a standard AIA contract, has been clear and straightforward. As the Silverton Court explained, the owner, who is responsible under the contract for obtaining insurance that covers damage to the work, waives claims for damages to the work. But the owner does not waive claims for damage to the non-work because the contractor is responsible under the contract for obtaining insurance to cover damage to the non-work. Over the last decade or so, there has not really been any problem, as far as I can tell, with implementing Silverton's bright line rule. The Court of Appeals, as far as I know, has never been called upon to mediate any disputes between parties to this contract. Parties in Colorado seem to be able to understand what the rule in Silverton is there for. And the rule in Silverton really effectuates this broader context and the parties' broader intent in entering into a very specific risk allocation scheme. But now, Amoco's insurance carrier has decided that they don't want to pay for negligent damage that Amoco caused to non-work property at Copper Mountain. And this, in spite of the fact that Amoco willingly and voluntarily agreed that it would carry liability insurance to cover just this risk. That is,
Ms. Harris, I guess at the onset, I'm a little bit taken aback, I guess, by your suggestion that that's been so clear in Colorado. And I guess what I'd like you to comment on is, I understand that's what the Court of Appeals has said, but given that it's a not the final arbiter on that issue necessarily, and given the division in the states, it seems to me that instead people, that anyone using this form contract with open eyes perceives that there are different interpretations of it. Could you respond to that? I mean, is that accurate, or am I for some reason missing something with that notion?
Well, Your Honor, I do think it's true that the jurisdictions have split on this. There are some jurisdictions that follow the Colorado Court of Appeals rule in Silverton, and others that that depart from that rule. But I do think that parties who enter into this contract in Colorado have a good sense of what the rule is, because since Silverton, and I understand that's a Court of Appeals case, but since Silverton, there has not been any occasion for the court to revisit that rule. So I do think it's fair for the parties to understand what they're getting into. But even more important, I think that if the parties read the contract, they can understand very clearly what they're getting into, because the allocation of risk here is so clear from the terms of the contract. The owner agrees, I, the owner, will get insurance to cover the work. The contractor agrees, I, the contractor, will get insurance to cover damage to the non-work property. Okay, well, now we're going to waive claims. How should we decide how we're going to waive claims? Well, waivers of subrogation always work the same way. They track the responsibilities of the parties. So you decide, owner or contractor, that you are going to cover a known risk. That is exactly the claim that you waive under the waiver of subrogation provision. You can't have a waiver of subrogation provision that is completely divorced from the responsibilities of the parties to the contract. That doesn't make any sense. That provides a windfall for one or the other of the parties. And here, the way that the Court of Appeals in this case read the contract, there is a windfall for the contractor. And it creates all of these other types of problems too. I mean, in this case, what you get at the end of the day, and the way you know that this waiver of subrogation provision does not fit in this contract, not the way the Court of Appeals is reading it, is that similarly situated property owners are being treated differently under the Court of Appeals rule here. And what I mean by that is this. If the property owner, this is according to the Court of Appeals rule in this case, if the property owner is, say, going to build a barn on their property, and they get separate builder's all risk insurance to cover the barn. And then they maintain their regular property insurance on their home. If the contractor negligently burns down the home, the property insurance will reimburse the homeowner. And then in that scenario, the homeowner's property insurer may sue the contractor because the property insurance does not count as insurance applicable to the work. That would be the builder's all-risk insurance. But let's say the property owner decides that instead of getting a separate builder's all-risk insurance policy, they will simply extend, as Copper did in this case, their existing property insurance policy to cover the work. There's no question that the homeowner agrees to cover the work, but they're going to do it through their regular existing property insurance policy. In that case, if the contractor burns down the homeowner's home, the property insurer reimburses the homeowner, but now the property insurer may not, under the Colorado Court of Appeals rule in this case, may not sue the contractor for his own negligence. That creates some sort of a disparity that I cannot explain and does not jibe with what the responsibilities of the parties are in this case.
Counsel, can I get you to back up and slow down to, I guess, your preliminary point was that when the owner is buying insurance, that they're essentially agreeing to insure the work. So it would make no sense to waive claims with regard to the non-work. Is that your fundamental position?
That's correct, that there is a risk allocation scheme here and that the waiver of subrogation provision enforces that scheme. It doesn't subvert it somehow, it enforces it. So yes, that's exactly right. The owner has agreed to cover damage to the work and the contractor has agreed to cover damage to the non-work as a result of his negligence.
And so basically your fundamental argument is that we have to not just start with interpreting the waiver provision, but start with what's actually insured or what the parties agreed to insure.
That's correct. When you look at a waiver of subrogation provision, you always have to read it in the context of what the requirements on the parties are. You can't read it separate from that. And in this case, the context is quite important because it does so starkly set out the different responsibilities and the different risks that each of the parties has assumed. So yes, you have to read the waiver of subrogation provision in the context of each of the parties' responsibilities.
Thank you.
Now, I understand there's been a change in the form contract between the Silverton case and this case. Is that right?
Your Honor, Amoco says that there has been a change in not the waiver of subrogation provision itself, but in the earlier provision, 11.4.5. And that's what the what Amoco calls the extension or expansion of the waiver of subrogation provision. And the change that they note is that instead of 11.4.5 saying that if during the course of construction the owner insures properties adjoining or adjacent to the project site, now the phrase says if during the course of construction the property owner, the owner insures properties at or adjacent instead of adjoining or adjacent to the property site. And that's the change that they note and claim that somehow that change now transforms the waiver of subrogation provision in 11.4.7 into this broad standalone waiver that applies to non-work. And that is not how we read 11.4.5, and it's not a fair reading of 11.4.5 if you keep in mind what the risk allocation here was. And let me explain what I mean by that. 11.4.5 actually does match up with the party's insurance obligations. So if you read it in the context of the entire contract, you will see that 11.4.5 really doesn't apply to non-work at all. Under 11.4.1, the owner has an obligation to get all risk insurance, not just on the work being performed by a single contractor, but on the entire project. Those are the owner's obligations set out in the owner's insurance section. So that means that the owner has to get work on, has to get all risk insurance on all of the separate work being performed as part of the project. So what 11.4.5 says is that if the owner then has other properties that are insured during the course of construction, meaning other properties added to the project, but under different insurance policies for whatever reason, the waiver of subrogation from 11.4.7 is going to apply to those properties. So in other words, you may not add in another part of the project to the work site and then say to all of the contractors at the work site, well, I'm sorry, I don't actually have all risk insurance on that part of the project. I do have it on this part of the project. No, the owner's responsibility is to insure all of the work at the project site.
So, and your point is, that doesn't make any difference for purposes of analyzing this case.
Well, no, what I'm saying is that then the waiver that occurs under 11.4.5 is not to non-work property. It's that the waiver of subrogation now applies to the entire project. You can't pick and choose. If something happens, if you're building three structures in your backyard and you have all risk insurance on two, and now you decide you're going to add in this third project or this third piece of work to the project, the owner cannot say, if that third structure burns down, cannot say, well, I'm sorry, I had builder's all risk insurance on the two structures, but not on the third. So now I will try to determine which one of you contractors at this project site is responsible for burning down the third structure. No, the owner's obligation under the contract is to cover damage to all of the work at the project site. It doesn't matter what kind of insurance the owner wants to call it. If it's part of the project, it's the owner's responsibility to cover it, and if there's damage to the project, the owner agrees to be responsible for that. But that does not flip the entire rest of the contract on its head. The owner does not, through 11.4.5, suddenly decide all bets are off. And that what I really meant when I signed this contract was that I'm also responsible for all of the damage to the non-work property. That's what Amoco says 11.4.5 does. And that's what the Court of Appeals sort of suggested that maybe it does do. But that can't be right. The waiver of subrogation has to fit with the requirements that each of the parties have under the contract. And the court's reading and Amoco's reading of 11.4.5 is totally separated out from any of the requirements that the parties have.
Can I just go over that language with you for a moment? The 11.4.5. Because if during the project construction the owner insures properties at or adjacent to the site of the property under policies separate, and here's the language I'm confused about, from those insuring the project. So what's the project?
The project is defined in the contract.
Is the project the same as the work?
It is not the same as the work. Under 1.4, the contract makes clear that the project encompasses all of the work, and that could be done by separate contractors who are out at the project.
Could you give me just an example? So I have a house, I want to build a garage and a shed. So now figure this out for me.
Okay, so now your garage, let's say you have separate contractors doing the shed and the garage, okay? The owner is now responsible for making sure there is builder's all risk insurance on both the garage and the shed. Even if you add the shed in later as part of the project, now the owner has a responsibility under 11.1.4, the regular insurance requirement. Now the owner has a responsibility to continue to insure all of the property that makes up the project. And it's not fair for the owner to say, well, I got builder's all risk on the garage, but I'm gonna let some other property insurance cover the shed.
Then the work is the garage, the project is the garage and the shed?
Correct. And the owner has a responsibility for covering damage to all of the work at the project, that's part of the project. So Copper agrees that it has waived any right to collect for damages to any of the work at the project, that's part of the project. Here, there's no such distinction. The work was the project. In many cases, though, and this is what 11.4.5 guards against, the project and the work are not coextensive. In your case, Your Honor, with the garage and the shed, being if the work is performed by two separate contractors, or even if it's not, that's now a project, and the owner agrees to accept responsibility for any damage that occurs to the project, but not to non-project work. There's nothing about 11.4.5 that would support that. And
so,
it does.
So if I'm not agreeing to cover my house, non-project work.
Correct. Right. And if you take the Court of Appeals rule.
I'm sorry, I missed that. What about the at? So at or adjacent to the side of the property, at my house or adjacent to my house? You think at is only at the garage or at the shed?
No, I think at or adjacent means at the project site. So if you add properties into the project site, you, the owner, are responsible for getting all risk insurance on those properties.
But so there's no, I'm sorry, one more interruption if you allow me. So there's no distinction between at and adjacent?
I don't think there is a distinction. That
those are just two words they didn't need, an extra word they didn't need?
No, I think that this is just an example of the drafters trying to be as careful as possible so that there's no question about what they're talking about. So that if your garage is 2 feet from your house, but your shed is 4 feet from your house, look, there's no bickering about it. You're at or adjacent, it's good enough, you're going to wrap it in, the owner's going to be responsible for getting insurance to cover that work because the owner's responsible for the entire project. What happens if you read 11.4.5 the way the Court of Appeals did and the way Amoco urges that you read it is, again, you get this situation where similarly situated owners are treated completely differently. So under the Court of Appeals rule, if the owner decides not to insure any of the work at or adjacent to the, I'm sorry, any of the property at or adjacent to the site, and all of the property burns down, well, the contractor's responsible for that.
Ms. Harris, can I ask you over here?
Yes, sorry.
I want to follow up on Justice Rice's focus on 11.4.5. I found that extremely confusing because I think that is, that particular paragraph is critical. And in looking at this contract, I'm looking at the right one. The project is a defined term, and it seems to me that your reference, you distinguish between work and the project to accept your argument. And I don't quite understand that, only because it says the project is the total construction of which the work performed under the contract. So what I don't really get, how is that different from the work, which says the term work means the construction and services required by the contract documents? It seems to me we're talking about almost the same thing.
Well, Justice Bender, if you keep going in that provision, it says it's the total construction of which the work performed may be the whole or it may be the part, and it includes construction by the owner or by separate contractors. So that means that if you have separate AIA contracts with your separate contractors and you are all together at this work site, the owner is going to cover all of that work. And when some of the work burns down, the owner is not going to try to point fingers. The owner is just going to accept responsibility.
Right. But then why doesn't it include the work that was done here when there was only one contract? So, in other words, you're making the assumption that the word project refers to things other than the work.
It can, and I'm
right,
saying
right,
that 11.
But you're making your assumption in order to get out of that 11.4.7 waiver, right?
Well, I'm not trying to make the assumption to get out of it, Your Honor. What I'm trying to do is explain that 11.4.5 anticipates exactly what the definition of project is. It uses the word project. It doesn't say project or work. It says project. It says if during the project construction period you get insurance separate from the project, then whatever that insurance policy is on this work that you've now brought into the project is going to be covered. In this case, the project and the work are the same, but 11.4.5 has a specific purpose. And what it says is, this is how we are delineating work. we are saying that your responsibilities include work not just by this one contractor, but it requires that you cover work being performed by all contractors. That's the point of 11.4.5, is to make sure that the owner takes full responsibility for the project site. And that way, if there is damage to the work at or adjacent to the project site, then both parties know that the owner's insurance is going to pick that up. You're not going to try to figure out, was it the contractor's fault who's working on the shed, or is it the contractor who's working on the garage? Who caused the damage? There's none of that. It's much more efficient this way. The owner has agreed to pick up damages to the work, but not to the non-work.
Ms. Harris, may I ask one more question about this language in 11.4.5? Not so much about the distinction between project and work or that. But maybe I'm reading this wrong, but on its face, it seems to talk about insuring properties adjacent to the site under policies that are separate from those insuring the project, not ones that in which the project has expanded or you've added to the project, but properties that are separate from those that are insured, those that insure the project. Why doesn't that imply any insurance, any other insurance that the owner has gotten on these adjacent properties?
The owner's requirement, though, under the contract, you can't read 11.4.5 separately. You have to look at what the owner agreed to do at the front end. And at the front end, the owner agreed to cover the entire project. So the owner can't cover another property that's part of the project. In order to be part of the project, it has to be work to be part of the project. So the owner can't cover some other property that's now part of the project slash work with some other insurance policy and then claim that insurance.
But the owner surely can cover other properties that it owns that are not part of the project.
Surely, it can.
Okay, and why does this language not refer to that coverage and seem to suggest not an obligation to cover, but rather simply if the owner has covered other properties apart from the project and they are damaged, that the owner is agreeing to waive separate going after damages with regard to those as well? And would that not be a policy then that would be, maybe it's not the one that was intended, but is it not a legitimate policy to say, in effect, we're both waiving with regard to anything that's covered by insurance?
You could write a contract like that. But that's not this contract. This contract is pretty clear about which risks each party is going to assume. And if you try to pick out from some of the language in 11.4.5 and try to ride that language as sort of, well, now we understand what the intent of the parties was because of 11.4.5, you have to ignore the entire rest of the contract. And I say the better way to read this provision is to try to harmonize it with the rest of the contract. And to do that, all you have to do is agree that the owner has a responsibility to insure the project. If any properties come under now the project, it doesn't matter what the insurance policy is called.
Let's go with your thought about harmonizing, which we'd all like to do here. But do that with regard to the specific language of 11.4.5. How does one harmonize in the way that you suggest language that talks about insurance to properties that are adjacent to the site when you've got language that says under policy separate from those insuring the project?
Right, but that's the very point. That's the very scenario that 11.4.5 is trying to guard against, is that the owner can't rely on this sort of separate insurance. You can't say, I have builders all risk to cover part of the project, but then I have this separate insurance that's going to cover this part of the project, this one thing, this garage or this shed. That's what it's saying. If you do that, if you try to insure properties that are part of the project under some other insurance policy that really does not provide the coverage that you're obligated to provide, you are not going to get away with that as the owner. The owner has agreed to cover the project, no matter what you call your insurance policy. If it's part of the project, then the waiver of subrogation is going to apply to that policy. You can't get away with trying to say this is a separate policy. That's exactly what the provision is trying to guard against. And if I can just give an example of how this plays out incorrectly if you follow the Court of Appeals reasoning here. So what the Court of Appeals says is under their rule, if the owner decides, they say, look, this shows an intent to, for the owner to pick up damage to non-work, because it really means any property around the work site, well, you've just waived your claims to any damage that occurs. But what that leads to is now an owner decides, I'm not going to insure any of my property around the work site. And all of that property burns down, and now the contractor has to pay for it. But the good owner who says, I'm going to maintain my property insurance on the property around the work site, when that burns down, well, now I guess that owner's out of luck. That doesn't make any sense. That rewards bad, irresponsible conduct on the part of the homeowner. So you don't want to penalize the responsible homeowner who keeps property insurance on his property. Why in the world would this contract be set up so that it provides an incentive for the homeowner to ditch entirely its property insurance on the theory that in that case, boy, then I can get the contractor to pay? It doesn't make any sense. It's a much easier read to read 11.4.5 the way Copper does, which is, everybody's got their responsibilities. Everybody's got their risks that they assumed. We assume the risk for everything at the project. No fair trying to say it's not Builders All Risk. No fair trying to say it's a separate insurance policy. The owner's responsible. If there's damage to the work, there's no finger pointing. The owner picks it up. But damage to the non-work, we've all agreed that goes to the contractor.
Could I ask just one last quick question about the 4.5? That being the case, since elsewhere it is clear the owner has the obligation to insure the project, why is 11.4.5 necessary at all? What does it add?
Well, it guards against just what you've identified, which is that as new property is added into the project.
But doesn't that become the project then? So under other provisions, doesn't the owner have an obligation to insure against?
Right, and this makes sure that it says you better know that if you get separate insurance, you're subject to the waiver of subrogation provision in 11.4.7. You can't get out of it. You're subject to that no matter what kind of separate insurance you might get on the rest of this project. So that's exactly the point. Okay. And I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good morning, may it please the court. Melissa Schisler on behalf of Amoco Resort Construction. I would first like to advise the court that defense counsel have agreed to split our time, so I will use up to 15 minutes if necessary, and then I'll turn the floor over to Mr. Murphy. I would first like to point out that many of the difficulties in construing this particular contract can easily be alleviated if we follow the majority position as opposed to the position taken in Silverton. In particular, I think it was Justice Bender who was discussing or struggling with what's the project, what's the work. Justice Rice brought that up as well. It does get rather confusing, and if we don't distinguish or don't define the waiver by what is work and what is non-work, but rather by whether the damage is covered by insurance, we don't get into those difficult fact determinations, and it keeps trial courts out of the loop of trying to say, well, okay, this project is a renovation or a remodel project. Part of the project is demolishing a wall. And maybe expanding a room. Well, if damage occurs during the course of that project, during the demolition work, is that amount to work, or does that amount to non-work because the wall was already in existence? So it really gets into difficult fact determinations that maybe the trial court isn't particularly equipped with answering. And if we follow the majority rule saying, you know, as long as there was some insurance there that paid for this loss, the parties don't need to litigate against each other. So
that sounds like a policy reason as opposed to just a construction or interpretation of a contract.
And I would agree. That is a policy reason for following the majority.
And we should really look to the contract first before we get into it.
Okay. That's fine. I also believe that the Court of Appeals accurately, in this matter, accurately interpreted the contract. When you look at the types of contracts each party was obligated to obtain here, the whole purpose of it is to make sure there isn't some property that's left uncovered. So generally speaking, a builder's risk policy will cover many things that, let's say, the liability policy the contractor would get wouldn't cover. For example, builder's risk covers, that's what it's for, is to cover damage during construction. And a liability policy that contractors normally have, that the types of damage that would be covered under the builder's risk policy would likely be excluded under a liability policy, such as, you know, damage to your ongoing work. There's specific exclusions for that. So the whole intent of the contract was to make sure there's overlaps in coverage. So here, if Copper had gotten a builder's risk policy instead of relying on its existing huge policy covering all these different resorts, that policy may not have covered some of the things the liability policy would have covered, like if a crane fell over and hit somebody, or you know, somebody gets run over by a backhoe. That's where the liability policy would come in. So when you look at the global purpose of the party's intent, or the risk shifting allocation in the contract, that's why you have those different roles. But here, Copper's insurance did cover the loss, and under 11.4.5, because it covered the loss, they waived any claims they had against Amoco. So in terms of the contract...
It seems just like a strange result, and you're asking us to overturn a case that, you know, has been in effect a decade and has governed these relationships here in Colorado. And so why should we do that?
Well, first of all, it reflects a minority view, and I'll get into the reasons. I explained one of the advantages to following the majority view. But Silverton also specifically distinguished itself from cases involving prior versions of AIA contracts, and that's at 948 P2, page 13, which is instructive here because we do have a different version. I think Justice Malarkey initially brought up the change in the AIA contract, that it's at or adjoining now, as opposed to adjacent and adjoining. I believe that was the language change. The drafters of these AIA contracts specifically made that change for some reason. I don't believe that it was superfluous just to say get rid of adjoining and put at instead. So that's one reason maybe Silverton is outdated, because it's looks to a different form of the AIA contract. Another problem we have with the Town of Silverton matter is the damage occurred after construction was completed. And that's a somewhat significant change as well, distinction. Because here we have damage that occurred during construction, and so this Town of Silverton case thought that distinction was important, because they did specifically bring it up at the same page I mentioned, 948 P2, 13. And that distinction is important, because if all the town had was its builder's risk policy, a builder's risk policy doesn't cover damage once a project is completed. So to say that the town somehow waived claims because of the builder's risk policy, that would have left some property uncovered, which doesn't comport with the intent of the contract.
Well, let me get this straight now. It's a waiver of a policy you paid for this protection. It just nullifies the policy. Right? I mean,
basically. Sorry, I don't understand your question.
Well, in the circumstance, I mean, the coverage that Amoco is denying has been paid for, but there's no benefit of that because of this waiver. I mean, that's the theory, right?
You mean that it was paid for under Copper's policy?
Yeah.
Well, there's a benefit that Copper doesn't remain out hanging. Their property damage was covered. Now their carrier can't go after Amoco because of the waiver provision.
Yeah,
because they had insurance. So, and I think the purposes of these contracts are not necessarily to protect insurance carriers, but to protect the parties to the contract.
But there are risks that are allocated among these carriers. And
correct. And it may not be a big factor that Copper didn't get the builder's risk policy, but that's the facts we have. And since they didn't, they let their carriers be out there to cover this part of the risk.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question.
Well, I think it does. Trying to understand the interrelationship.
Okay. Some of the other advantages to following this, the majority rule as opposed to the rule we've had in town of Silverton for the past 10 years or so, is that it does allow for consistency, certainty, and uniform expectations among contractors around the country. So if you have a contractor doing a project in Nebraska or Colorado or Vermont or one of the other states, which interprets these AIA form contracts the way the Court of Appeals did in this case, then they know the contract means what it means no matter where they're performing their work. So, that's another reason for adopting this view.
I just want to make sure that I absolutely understand that you don't think you can win unless we overrule Silverton.
I don't think that is necessarily true. I think that I think Silverton could be overturned. On the other hand, the Court of Appeals didn't choose to distinguish Silverton, but I think it can be distinguished for the reasons I mentioned previously, because it did involve an earlier form of the contract. It did involve facts where the damage occurred after construction as opposed to during construction, which isn't significant because of the types of insurance policies that were in effect. And in fact, the Steamboat versus Backjack case is a little bit more similar to the case here, because there the damage occurred during construction, and like this case, the owner did not have a builder's risk policy in place. So if the court doesn't wish to overturn Silverton, I think there's ways to get around that to distinguish it. And the other reason, another reason that Silverton could be distinguished is based on its facts in terms of the work being much easier delineated than in a remodeling type of project, where work and non-work are really integrated, and the fact question is very difficult to determine. But the bottom line to me is, if you look at the particular contract sections, Copper was supposed to have some form of insurance to cover the project or the work under 11.4.1, and under 11.4.7, it waived all rights to the extent covered by property insurance obtained pursuant to paragraph 11.4. And if you look at 11.4.5, it also agreed to waive any claims at or adjacent to the site by any insurance. And I apologize, I'm not quoting the exact language, but in any event, because Copper met its obligation under 11.4.1 by using its policy, that policy covered the loss by virtue of 11.4.7 it waived any claims for that damage. And if you don't have any more questions for me, I'll go ahead and let Mr. Murphy argue for his client.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the court and the council. Good morning. I am Dan Murphy, and I have the privilege of representing Industrial Systems, the subcontractor on the project. Going last, at least with respect to the appellees, sort of leaves me in the position of not knowing precisely where to start. But Justice Bender talked about looking at the contract, and my esteemed opposing counsel suggested that if we look at the contract, the party's intent in allocating risk is clear. I agree with her. If you will look at 11.4, it talks about property insurance. 11.1 talks about liability insurance. 11.4.1 through 11.4.5 talk about the various types of insurance that the owner should buy. It is property insurance, it is loss of use insurance, it is insurance for boilers and machinery. As we've talked about in 11.4.5, the owner can even buy separate policies of insurance which cover things at or adjacent to the project. 11.4.6 is the next paragraph, and what it says to the parties is that the owner may not cancel or reduce the insurance that's been purchased without 30 days written notice to the contractor. 11.4.7, if the majority is correct, says that to the extent the owner has purchased property insurance, everybody waives claims, with one exception. The exception 11.4.7 says that to the extent the parties disagree on the allocation of insurance proceeds, they can fight about that. 11.4.8 says that the owner has a fiduciary obligation to the parties to adjust, that is, distribute the insurance proceeds. 11.4.9 says that the owner, if she wants to, can terminate the contract for convenience. Or, alternatively, the owner has the right to have the contractor proceed with repairs to the damaged property. We don't care if it's worth or non-worth. And to the extent that the contract needs to be modified in scope or price, they have a right to do that under Article 7. And then to complete my thought, Article 11.4.10, the final paragraph, says that to the extent there is a disagreement over the allocation of the insurance proceeds, then that goes to mediation or arbitration. I respectfully submit that when one looks at the entirety of Article 11.4, it is clear that to the extent there is insurance purchased by the owner to cover a loss, then claims are waived. And indeed, with respect to policy considerations, if we follow the majority, if we do what 11.4 requires, we have eliminated or reduced litigation. We have also, and this is critically important to the parties of a construction contract.
Yes, sir. How do you square your construction with 11.1?
Very good. 11.1.1 talks about the contractor's purchase of liability insurance, not property insurance.
Liability insurance, not?
Not property insurance. It then, in 11.1, provides, I think, seven subcategories that need to be covered. Those subcategories include such things as insurance for workers' compensation, for personal injury, for death, for motor vehicles, and of course, in subparagraph 5, coverage for damage to tangible property.
To the work.
Pardon me?
To the work itself, right?
I don't think so.
It says that.
Justice Bender.
It says for other than to the work, I'm sorry.
Yes, that's right. Things like, for example, a crane is damaged on the project. welding equipment is damaged on the project, things like that. But that said, let's assume that that also includes insurance for the non-work.
Right.
The truth is, I don't mean to be the least bit flip. I don't care. Because what 11.4.7 says is that we all waive claims for losses that are covered by the owner's property insurance. That is the majority ruling. And Justice Rice, you asked what I thought was an important question, which is, do we need this court to distinguish or overrule Silverton? The answer, like any good lawyer, is yes. We tried, the appellees tried at the district court level to distinguish Silverton. We tried at the Court of Appeals level to distinguish Silverton. And in fact, hardworking and smarter lawyers than myself can certainly come up with reasons to distinguish Silverton. But in my world, which involves purely the representation of architects, engineers, contractors, and subcontractors, it is my experience, Justice Rice, that if the vampire is not killed with a stake through the heart, it will come back. I respectfully submit that the Court of Appeals, although in my view, I think, attempted to distinguish Silverton, really rejected Silverton. And if we are to avoid coming back here in the future, my view of the world, with great respect, is that Silverton needs to be killed.
Can I ask you, pardon me, just a practical question? Having nothing to do with vampires. It strikes me that this kind of contract is made for fairly substantial commercial projects, right?
Really all types of commercial
projects. Right. Well, but there are usually some, and if you're involved with architects, you usually have a fair sum involved.
I agree.
And that's your expertise. So why is 1.1 even there, other, I mean, 1.1.5, I guess, is what I'm really talking about. Why is it even there under your reading of 11.4.5? Because if it's always waived, and it seems to me that any it's going to be the rarest kind of commercial operator, it's not going to have some sort of all-risk homeowner's insurance that would cover, you know, a lot of these things. So why is it even in there? Because it seems totally inconsistent.
That is really the question that was examined by the Supreme Court of Nebraska in 2008 in the Lexington versus, I think it's Entrex, E-N-T-R-E-X, case. In Lexington, there was a tower, some sort of a crazy antenna, that was worked on, that fell and damaged also an adjacent building. The Nebraska Supreme Court looked at 11.4.7 and determined, as has the majority, that to the extent insurance covered anything, the claims were waived. And indeed, in that case, there was one policy that covered both the antenna and the building. And so the Supreme Court then wandered out loud in its opinion about 11.4.5. And why would you put in 11.4.5 if you already have 11.4.7? And what the Supreme Court of Nebraska concluded was that the owner who buys insurance, who has the foresight not to just buy, for example, an all-risk policy, but the foresight to buy all-encompassing policies, in doing that, all claims are waived to the extent covered by insurance. And the Supreme Court of Nebraska then said that our reading, their reading, of 11.4.5 simply cements their read of the majority opinion, which is, to the extent the owner buys insurance, whether under 11.4.1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, claims are waived. At the risk of making my client mad, who has, I assume, going to pay for a tremendous amount of preparation, if there are no additional questions, I'll actually sit down some.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
What is the responsibility on the contractor then?
under your theory?
The contractor's obligation for insurance?
Yes.
It's set forth in 11.1.
Well, say more.
It's the contractor's obligation under 11.1 is to purchase liability insurance. And I've described in the seven subsections in 11.1 what that insurance generally must cover, including, arguably, Chief Justice, insurance for damages to the non.
So are you saying that the contractor has no if you're dividing up liability and property insurance, that the contract does not obligate the contractor to get any property insurance? Is that right?
If we interpret that subparagraph 5 of 11.1, then the contractor is obligated to purchase insurance for the non-work. It does not, however, change the result of 11.4, which is property insurance. And 11.4.7 is clear that to the extent the owner has purchased property insurance, all claims are waived to the extent that the owner's property insurance covers those losses.
So in this particular case then, as I understand, Copper had very broad insurance coverage for all of its properties.
That is correct, Chief Justice.
And you're saying that trumps whatever insurance the contractor might have had?
That is correct, yes. And that is precisely the ruling of the majority and what the Nebraska Supreme Court examined and concluded in the Lexington case.
Well, let me go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask one follow-up sort of on that, or a little spin-off. Several places the Court of Appeals seemed to place emphasis on the fact that Copper Mountain didn't buy a separate policy, a separate all-risk policy for the work, but rather relied on its general ski area coverage. For purposes particularly of the 11.4.5, is that significant at all?
In my view, no.
Okay.
The Nebraska Supreme Court in Lexington and other courts across the country have said that 11.4.7 stands by itself for the proposition that to the extent the owner has purchased property insurance to cover loss, all claims are waived to the extent of the coverage.
And so without regard to the Court of Appeals talked several places about because Copper relied on their all-purpose coverage to cover the work and seems to make that a condition for why they conclude the way they do. But you're saying that wouldn't make any difference as long as they have insurance that covers other properties. They would waive any claim for damages with regard to those properties as well.
That is correct.
Okay.
And then I guess my question does follow logically from Justice Coates. Why then isn't your interpretation of 11.4.5 and particularly the way the provision starts, which is if during the project construction, etc., why isn't that indeed a disincentive, as suggested by Ms. Harris, for the owner to get insurance? And it seems like it probably is, and if indeed it is, why isn't that bad policy? Two questions.
It's really not a bad decision. Perhaps standing here, Copper would, or any owner, in fairness, would want the court to believe that they don't have an incentive to buy as much property insurance as they possibly can afford. In fact, in the real world, and at the time of construction, the owner has the absolute incentive to buy as much insurance as possibly can be afforded to protect the owner in the event of loss. And really, that's what the waiver of subrogation provision does. The purpose of the waiver, and it's cited in page 10 of Industrial's brief, is to avoid disruptions, that is, delays and disputes caused by the fire.
And you're saying that the reason they have that incentive is, of course, they want to be covered, and secondly, they want to avoid litigation? Or why are you saying it's obvious in the real world that this is the case?
Because the worst thing that can happen in the event of a fire during construction is delay. Delay results in enormous consequential damages to the owner, and frankly, can put a contractor or subcontractor out of business. That's why 11.4 says that the risk of loss shifts to the insurance company. to pay the loss, to get everybody back up on their feet.
It shifts if the owner has accepted that risk of loss by buying the insurance.
Correct.
Which the owner isn't required to do.
The owner must purchase the all-risk insurance, but I do agree with your read of 11.4.5 to the extent that the owner has...
Well, I don't know if that's my read. I just... Ms. Harris's read.
Right. 11.4.5 does not, in my view, mandate the purchase of separate policies.
I'm still confused about this. Subrogation, of course, is a normal rule. Your own company pays, you know, they go after the person,
yes,
the other carrier. So that's waived here. And it's not entirely clear to me that Silverton was absolutely wrong regarding the non-work. So somehow between the carriers, there's some difference in the premium that's going to be charged, obviously, to the owner if the subrogation doesn't apply, right? I mean, that follows, doesn't it? I mean, this is a dispute within the carriers themselves.
It is.
Right?
I don't think it's pure speculation on my part, but yes, if an owner is buying insurance where the carrier loses its right to subrogate against the negligent contractor,
right,
then I assume the premium is going to be a bit higher.
Yeah.
And the advantage to the owner for accepting that higher premium, you think, is what?
Yes.
Speed, certainty.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. Critical things in a construction project. With that, I want to thank the court for its time and will yield to my opposing counsel. Thank you all.
Thank you. Now I really have to talk fast. But I think what I heard Amico say now is that if the property owner has a separate property insurance policy and a separate builder's all-risk policy, and the non-work is damaged, and the property insurance pays, that now the property owner can't recover. Nobody actually thinks that. The property insurance in that case would not be insurance applicable to the work. Under anybody's theory, there's not a single case out there that says if the property owner has two separate insurance policies, one that covers the work, the builder's all risk, and one that's regular property insurance, and there's damage to non-work, that now the property insurance qualifies as other insurance applicable to the work.
Applicable to the project or work, doesn't really matter
under,
in your context.
Right, under 11.4.7, okay. It says other property insurance applicable to the work. Nobody thinks that. The question here is only, if you have one, should you be treated differently? Let me just...
So put that in context of 11.4.5.
Yeah.
Just run your argument through that.
Well, 11.4.5 is really just an enforcement of this risk allocation that runs all the way through the contract. There is no deviation from this risk allocation here. Contractor gets insurance to cover damage to the non-work, and the owner gets insurance to cover damage to the work, including all of the work at the property. That's all. So that's the risk allocation scheme here. The problem here is that the Court of Appeals rule and what Amico is urging is really just this rule that depends on how the owner decides to comply with his or her requirements under the contract. That's not the issue. The issue is, what kind of a risk has the owner assumed? What kind of a risk has a contractor assumed? The contractor doesn't care how the owner cobbles together an insurance coverage to cover the work. That's between the owner and the owner's insurance company. And as you pointed out, Justice Hobbs, you are going to disrupt all kinds of arrangements between an owner and the owner's insurance company if you suddenly tell the owner's insurance company, guess what, usually you have a right to subrogation, but not here. And you didn't know about it, so you couldn't actually have charged the higher premium. So sorry to have just disrupted that entire arrangement.
Well, let me ask you a question. I understood Mr. Murphy to say that the contractor has no obligation to insure property.
Yeah, that's just not what the contract says. The contract says, and it does not say you must get liability insurance, the provision that talks about what the contractor has to get says the contractor shall purchase blah, 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 such insurance as will protect the contractor from the following claims. whatever insurance you need to get, contractor, to cover these claims, and here's one of them. Claims for damages other than to the work itself. Okay? Well, that's the contractor's job. And, Your Honor, you're entirely right. There does not seem to be any reason now for having that in there, because under Amoco and the Court of Appeals theory, all risk of loss is now shifted to the owner and the owner's insurance company. And that's not what the parties bargained for. Silverton is the right rule in this case. Thank you very much.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank all counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.